Welcome back to the Creator CEO. If it's your first time here, hello. I am really excited by today's episode. I have a special guest and a new co-host. We go into the dangers of oversubscribing to the theory of a niche and building your creator career to suit you individually as a person, not by what people say you should do, which often is a trap that we fall into. As always, if you are listening to the pod and you find a lot of value out of the pod, please drop us a follow. It helps us do more of this. It helps us get better guests. It helps us to invest more in the production. So please take a second to hit that follow button. Without further ado, here's the conversation with Milo. Welcome to the Creator CEO, where we unravel the business behind the content. We hear from creators, the people behind them, and the systems that they've built. I am excited that we are finally doing this. We met a couple of weeks ago in GDC and we came up with this idea of bringing you onto the pod, and we're gonna get into that. But I am, first of all, just so excited to be kicking this off together, not only because we've been buddies for a long time, so getting to do more stuff together is great, but also you are just a extremely thoughtful person when it comes to this industry, and I know that everyone listening is going to benefit from hearing from you.
Yeah, man, I'm excited to kick off a new chapter of things, new journey here, and get all of these thoughts that are stuck in my head out into the world. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, some of them, folks that are listening might not be a stranger. You know, we have done a lot together through Pipeline and through the Accelerator program. For those of you that were a part of that, you'll recognize Milo. But I do think it's worth, for those who may not be familiar with you, Milo, is maybe just giving a little bit of a background and context on your journey as a creator, how you got to here, kind of what you're doing today.
Sure. So I will give you the as condensed as possible version, which, as people will come to learn with me, is certainly more than just a sentence or two. So I started making content in 2009 when it was very uncool still. And the story there is sort of less interesting to this conversation. We can address some of the very, very early days another time, but several years went by and my content was very bad. And then in my first year of university in 2015, I grew as a person out of my shell in a new way. And my content kind of came out of its shell as well. And my views just cranked up from where they were previously. I was getting a couple thousand views a video maybe, and then pretty much overnight with the release of the Call of Duty that came out that year, Call of Duty Black Ops 3, I was getting 100k views a video. And it was a transformation that happened alongside me starting a physics degree, and I was like, oh crikey, there's a lot going on here. So dealt with that, finished my degree successfully, like stayed there the entire time. In 2015-16, I think I was top 100 fastest growing channels in the UK that year on YouTube. I was part of like a Google Accelerator program based on my channel growth. And then at the end of my degree, I went full-time doing this. And I've been full-time ever since. Now, full-time as a content creator means different things to different people. So for me, what that means is my primary focus is making my YouTube video content. I'm not someone that streams every single day or anything like that. I've never been someone that has been a streamer as my sort of primary income source. So I primarily put a lot of effort into the YouTube content that I make day to day, week to week. And I also am just extremely interested in all the different things that this industry kind of touches, all the different genres of content or all the different other businesses that sort of orbit as satellites around content creation. So something I'm very passionate about is working with game dev studios, for example, on their games that they're eventually going to be putting out, and trying to help from a creator perspective ensure that the game has tools and mechanics that can facilitate good content creation. Similarly, working to just make sure that the games are as polished as possible, because I like solving those sorts of problems. And then also working with various teams in the space that are doing stuff that just affect content creators. So whether it's merch or whether it's a company that's a platform that you might stream through, like a Streamlabs or a Stream Elements or those sorts of things, working with those types of companies to improve what they do. Elgato, like all these sorts of folks, is something I'm very passionate about. And amongst all of that, There's things like the Gaming Creator Accelerator that we ran last year, where I have for many years been really, really passionate about teaching. Much of the content that I put out on my YouTube channel is educational, despite the fact that it's video game content. I'm teaching people through these no-nonsense guides, as I call them, how to do complex tasks in video games. And my love of teaching in that area doesn't just stop at it being in-game activities only. I also like teaching other skills that I have, such as all of the stuff that I know how to do as a content creator. And so I was really jazzed to be able to help you guys put the Gaming Creator Accelerator together last year. And running that was so fulfilling for me, and seeing people's views change just overnight from even just having like a one-to-one was very deeply satisfying for me. And so I'm also very passionate about that side of things, and sort of have my own little offshoots of what I do content-wise that's specifically focused on creator education and being plugged into that whole kind of world. So lots of different fingers and lots of different pies there. I'm still today making content as my sort of primary income source, pumping out videos just like I was doing 15 years ago. So that is still very much my day-to-day. But the way that I approach those days has changed drastically over that time. And I'm sure that's going to be something that we get into a little bit today. But I now essentially have decided to make my life as difficult as possible by trying to do all of that work that I was already doing and a million more other things at once, because I love what I do. So that's me.
That is a lot of amazing context, and I couldn't help but smiling through it, because I've got to witness parts of that journey, especially in the last few years of us working together more closely. And, you know, coming into this episode, I was like, you know, we could have some sort of preconceived topic that we want to talk about and like really drill into that. But honestly, I think for me, just introducing you to the community and sharing the news that you're going to be doing this more frequently with us. So as part of you coming on, you know, you're going to be co-hosting the podcast. We'll do this episode together. There'll be episodes that we do without each other. And I think just given your, you know, 15 years in the space, you built a network for yourself. You built relationships for yourself. You have that experience of actually being a creator every single week. Like, that's still your main full-time thing that you're doing right now. And bringing that perspective to the pod is going to be incredibly beneficial for everyone who's listening. And honestly, just fascinating for me. Like, I just love the idea that the conversations we have, where we can spend hours off camera, we can start to have some of that here and beat it up and talk about it, and things that we're seeing on, that are seeing happening in our week, we can start to bring here and talk about it and start to open up that conversation more.
An addendum to what I said, and this is one of my flaws, I think, or one of my weaker points, is that I sometimes am not automatically in the headspace of talking about my accomplishments and sort of bigging myself up. So just as seeing as that actually,
I was
would
going
be
to
useful,
do that for you. To be clear, I was going to say, how big is your channel? I mean,
I just realized, I was like, that's probably relevant context.
It's a big thing to indicate why you should listen and be excited about Milo coming onto the pod. Because, yeah, 15 years is obviously a lot of experience, but it's the success that you've also had, Milo, over that time in becoming the dominant player in your niche in zombies. And you've also grown to millions of subscribers on YouTube. I've also witnessed you from us having an idea of we should go start trying something on a platform, and then within weeks, you growing that from nothing, not trying to like leverage your other channels to grow it, just growing it to, I think it was 30K subscribers you got that account to, within just a couple of weeks from an idea without leveraging your main channel. And I think it just goes to show the expertise and the experience that you built. I mean, how many views now have you gotten over the last decade?
Long form, and I like making that distinction, because nowadays it's very dangerous to slip up and be like, oh, well, if I include short form content, like 50 billion, but that number just doesn't mean anything, right? I actually saw, just as an aside, I saw, I think his name's Max Fosh, he just hit 1 billion views, and that's like 1 billion real long form meaningful views, which is awesome. And that's not to say that short form views don't count by any means, but this sort of gives you an idea of he's just hit a billion and he has been viral everywhere with several videos in the last few years, and he's only just hit a billy. So overall on long form, 500 million views. I think my peak sort of concurrence in a stream that I've ever had that was pure organic, no hosting or anything like that, was 33,000. But like I said, I stream very infrequently. I think I've probably created upwards of 3,000 plus videos. I don't have an actual tally on that, but it's many videos over the years that have all been by my hand rather than coming from an editor or whatever. And then maybe another 1,000 that have been edited by other people. So lots of output. I think my most viewed video is just about to hit 10 million views. And I probably have another 100 that are all over a million. So there's a lot of sort of success there, I think, just in the numbers. But what I also find really important to bring to the fore is not some of those metrics that a viewer might gauge a channel by, but actually some of the metrics that I judge my channel by, which are totally different. And I think some of the creators listening to this probably feel the same way, that sure, I can be like, well, I've got 2 million subscribers. Doesn't really mean, like, that doesn't tell you how I put bread on the table, right? So for me, I, over the last few months, have done a couple of different brand deals with a variety of different sort of partners, if you will, game studios, agencies, what have you. And in several of those deals, the video that I've created for that brand has been the most performant video for the game in that category, like on the entirety of YouTube. And so as far as I'm concerned, I could have 0 subscribers, but if I'm doing that for a game's ecosystem, there's a huge amount of value there. And it's almost regardless of what the actual view count is. If I'm working with a game that has a ceiling, right? Like a TAM of like 20K viewers, and I'm hitting 19K views on a video, 19K relative to my average, which is probably around 100K, is not that crazy. But if I'm actually blowing the doors off their ecosystem and being market leader in that regard for them, that's massively valuable. So those sorts of things are some of the ways that I currently assess my channel right now as well. And there's also just other tangential measures of success, I think, that have been really interesting for me over the years in sort of making sure that my imposter syndrome never kind of boils up. For me personally, it's never really been an issue, but it's just, these things are nice to have anyway. So for example, I've done work with several brands over the years that they touch the creator space in some capacity. And several times we've got to the end of an engagement and they've just given me a job offer. And I'm like, well, that's very flattering.
That's validation right there. Yeah, thank you.
It's like, it's very nice. You paid me for a limited campaign and it's been so good from your perspective that you would want to bring me on to just keep doing that forever. Like, that is lovely. And so like even right now, for example, there's a esports platform that I'm working with, and this is, we can talk about this another time. Let's not sort of stray there now, but I'm helping them out as almost like a fractional CMO to help them navigate the creator space as well, because that's one of the key pain points that they have right now that they need assistance with. And so that is a totally different measure of success compared to what you might, as a viewer, assume would be the main measure, which is just, yeah, your sub count. Things are changing these days. So yeah, that's just a little bit of the sort of suite of areas of how I measure myself, because oftentimes I think there's an assumption that one metric tells the full story, but I think that actually the choosing of the metric can sometimes be perhaps a more interesting question and a more interesting sort of a parameter space to explore.
Yeah, it's realizing what game you're playing and choosing what game to play. That's a little meta, but that is not just about Call of Duty or, you know, Fortnite. It's about what your objectives are. I mean, I know folks that have less than 50K subscribers on YouTube that have, you know, a 7-figure business. And that seems at odds with the conventional model if you grew up in that ecosystem, but there's just different games that those people are playing. And no one game is right. Like, everyone values things differently. And I think being super intentional about what game you're playing at what point in time in your journey as a creator is something that I think you have control over. But sometimes, like, it gets away from you a little bit and you're like, I don't have a choice. This is my identity, and I've built this and I've cultivated it. And it feels so hard to shift my identity. And I think you've been in this space now 15 years. How have you reconciled with this idea of, like, I built my name, my face in this area, and now I want to go take on these new interesting projects, whether it's consulting with a game dev studio or, you know, doing this brand deal or even working with us on the education side and helping creators. By the way, just a shout out to you, like, some of the impact that we've had in that program is absolutely ridiculous. Like, completely changed lives. 10x in views within 30 days is absurd. When just seeing the impact that you have when you can distill that down in the right space. So yeah, I want to double down on that, is this changing identity that you've had over the years, and like whether or not you have to stick to the thing that got you to where you are.
Part of the answer to this is within the umbrella of essentially building an audience that is attached to a niche of some description, and how you think about either expanding that niche, but sort of still keeping the niche itself, versus just jumping to a new niche entirely. Part of it is there. Part of it, I think, really needs to not be there, in the sense that I think a danger that a lot of creators sort of run into is they will attack problems of niche and problems of, like, what content style do I need to be doing next, and all these sorts of things, very much in the language and the mental framework of what their understanding is of the platform. This, to give you a sort of allegorical or a similar example, is also
allegorical?
Something... Oh, I love an allegory. Yeah. So,
for the other 50% of the audience that have no idea what the word allegorical means, like, I'm going to Google it right now. What does allegorical mean?
I'll let you, please, Stephen, let's act right, like the last 10 seconds didn't point. Happen. No, Stephen, please, based on definitely not Googling it in this present moment, define an allegory for me, please. A-L-L-E-G-O-R-Y. You know what this
is? Constituting or containing an allegory. I still have no idea what allegory
Tell
is.
Tell me what an allegory is, Stephen. Do another Google search. It's okay. We got time, baby. Let's do it.
I think ChatGPT is the future. I gotta Eli this like I'm five. Explain allegory to me like I'm five. Imagine you have a toy box full of different toys. Each toy can tell you a story or teach you something. An allegory is like playing with those toys to tell a bigger story. For example, if you have a toy lion who is the king of all animals and always does what is right, the lion might represent someone who is very brave and good in real life. When we use stories like characters like the lion to show bigger ideas, like being brave or good, that's called an allegory.
The overall wrapped up, simplified version of that, based on the fact that ChatGPT has given you a lot more to play with than you maybe need there.
I have more question marks.
Yes, exactly. Is more or less, I mean, obviously we're on a tangent here, but sort of moral that you can get, the moral of the story that you can get from a story or from an archetype or from a thing, that is... The story itself can be allegorical in that the moral of that story can be applied elsewhere, and you can kind of transferably learn from one place and apply to another, in my understanding. But also,
okay, that was helpful. Now we're talking the same language.
Yeah.
So it's whether or not you choose to take it elsewhere, you can make a complete pivot and apply that to a new realm.
Well, or no, you can... okay. So let me. So let me refer back to where I was going with this, right? So just a similar situation happens, I think, or there's an ongoing discussion about this that I've just been seeing TikToks and stuff on recently, in the sort of realization of how therapy speak, if you allow me to coin the phrase here, has changed the way that just interpersonal relationships are established and maintained, and how that sort of garden is watered, in the sense that we are living in a sort of society and a culture these days, which is, I would guess, more reflective on the sorts of things that would come up in therapy than maybe previous generations have been. There's a lot of sort of real focus on your own personal emotional growth and your emotional journey and all these sorts of things, right? And with that, we've needed language to develop to help us navigate that previously dark and dingy path. And the sorts of language that you can adopt from the context of therapy is really helpful for that. There's a danger, though, within that, I think, which is that as soon as you sort of go too far down that rabbit hole, you can almost start over-diagnosing yourself and over-prescribing yourself different solutions to different problems that you perceive to be problems based on the fact that that's your understanding of how the language works. But it's the language is like the front end of what you're seeing, but it's not the back end of the core idea necessarily, right? And the reason I bring this up, and I think that therapy is very useful, and I am absolutely I vouch for therapy. So this is not me saying like therapy speak is bad. It's just that it's interesting that the front end model that we use, the approximation, if you will, just based on how language works, is not telling the complete picture at all times. And the reason I bring that up is because in the context of YouTube, I think that a lot of YouTubers, all content creators of any kind, I sort of use YouTuber and content creator interchangeably, to be honest, but people in that position will, I think, frequently think within the established wording framework of what it means to be in a niche or not in a niche. But it means that their creativity and their instinct and their output is constrained to what they think fits in the buckets of the language that we've determined. And I think that there's benefit to that in that language is shorthand and it helps us convey these ideas. But similarly, if you have a preconceived notion of what is and isn't possible, your creativity may be buffeting up against barriers that would not otherwise be there should you have chosen to discard that language or to pay less heed to it in the first place. In choosing your niche, I think you can look at it two ways, right? Or expanding your niche, I think that was the crux of the question, right? You can look at it within the framework of, okay, let's talk about YouTube analytics and let's talk about your demographics and let's talk about niche and all of these phrases that make sense in that world. But we also need to talk about what it means to be a human with interests and what it means to build a business and what it means to do all these things that are separate to the content conversation. And it's by marrying those two things that I think you really find creator Valhalla. So we can get into both of those, but I've been rambling for a moment here. Does that make sense as I've presented it thus far?
It absolutely does. It makes way more sense than Allegory did to me 3 minutes ago. So I appreciate the breakdown. And on behalf of the other half of the audience too, I appreciate that deeply. So the this idea of finding it within, because I think we get really heady, like just society is extremely heady, and then finding it within, you mentioned when you were kind of coming up, your content sucked for the first couple of years.
Yep.
And then in uni, you changed as a person, and then fundamentally your content changed. And it feels like it's related like to this conversation we're having now, is the interplay between this inner intuition and then you as a person. How should someone kind of evaluate these chapters in like aligning it with who they are today and not who they were? I was having a fascinating conversation with Vicstar123, who phenomenal success in gaming. Then with the Sidemen group, obviously has accomplished a lot on the Sidemen side, doing a lot of IRL skits, comedy, massive, you know, productions that they're now doing. And now he's on this new journey of music.
Yeah.
And it's very much what is fueling his internal interest is guiding it. And he is very humbly approaching this new journey of music, and he's already experiencing a level of success. He has very high aspirations, obviously, but it's interesting how internally driven he is and how curious he is internally, rather than like, what's the logical next move I must make as a creator.
Yep. So that is a really perfect teeing up of the two sides, right, that I'm talking about, the like niche brain versus the internal brain, if you will. And it to speak to the example that you gave of me kind of coming out of my shell at university and how that impacted my content, I think nowadays the niche brain kind of cohort of people or cohort of thinking would say, okay, you're not performing, so you probably need to change the content that you're making to be in a niche that is higher performing. Like, you need the highest performing niche at all times. And like, to choose that, you might be searching for the highest possible CPMs on the content. You might be searching for the highest possible views on the content, like the highest possible volume of potential content and the ideas space within the niche to make sure that it's ripe for a long enough amount of time that you can rinse it after several years rather than just several weeks. Like, all those sorts of things, right? Yes, I can break down YouTube to those sorts of foundational pillars, absolutely. But that's not what I did in 2013, 14, 15, as my content turned a corner to suddenly blow up. There was actually zero change of niche. I just realized that I was doing a bad job within the niche I was already in because my content was not personable and accessible in the way that it needed to be. And there was genuinely zero change of niche there. There was just an internal change of direction in the sense that I realized that my style of delivery, even just the way that I was speaking in my videos, was not welcoming a new viewer in the way that it needed to. And so that was what I ended up, without even really consciously thinking about it, developing it in my personal life. I got better at that. I got more personable as a person. And that meant that in the content, it seeped in. Suddenly, I was someone that felt like an accessible person to talk to and have a dialogue with in a way that I hadn't been in the same way previously. And so as the content style stayed the same of Call of Duty, Easter egg tutorials, like gameplay guides, storyline exploration, like all those sorts of things, I went from doing it in a almost like an insular manner to doing it in a way that actually could tap the potential of the niche that I was already in. I just wasn't making the most of it because I was doing a bad job of it, because I wasn't a person that was set up to tap that success until those sorts of internal changes happened in me. And then I could pursue that further, right? So that's one of those places where we could talk all day long about the niche, but there's other work to be done in order to kind of move the needle there. And I think that in the Vic example as well, that's something where right now he probably recognizes that there's a million and one places that he can go with all of the success that he's had with the Sidemen into various different businesses or industries or what have you. And some of those will be more lucrative than others. And some of those will be bigger businesses than others. But ultimately, he also recognizes that the internal stare of where his passions are essential to listen to, and that's why he's doing the things that he's doing. And that's something that I see all creators of all sizes constantly battling with back and forth. And some people make decisions on one side and they follow the niche thing and they follow the lucrative side, and others follow the internal side. And there is no right answer. It's just all about finding balance that suits you, I think.
I think that's the key, is there's no right answer. You could listen to this pod and like, there's no golden nugget that's going to give you absolute clarity. I think it's more asking yourself the question and refining your own internal algorithm, for what it's worth, on understanding what's important to you and what do you need. Because over time, you're going to compound your learning on the analytical side and understanding platform X, Y, and Z, but really listening to yourself. I think it's so often when we are confined by time, like especially if you're streamers, I think face this even more than YouTubers to an extent, because they're just like, you know, might be doing 20 hours or 30 hours a week or even more of streaming. And there is no downtime. There's no stopping. It's just constantly on, and often don't listen to like what it is they want, where they want to go. What is that creative intuition pulling them towards? That inner voice often doesn't get listened to until there's just this kind of building dissatisfaction with whatever is happening. Even when the numbers are going the right way, there's just like an internal dissatisfaction that this can't be all there is. What, you mentioned way back when you had that moment in uni. I'm sure you've had it a couple of times since. Is there anything that has been helpful for you in reflecting on the journey? One of the things that when I first met you and you told me that you take a couple of months of the year off, I thought you were crazy, and I didn't believe it, I'll be honest. I didn't believe that you could possibly do that as a creator. You were the first person that I had met that had somehow managed to maintain a channel and take an extended period of time away from that channel.
Let me give some context on that. Once you're done here, I'll flesh that out a bit.
Yeah, no, I'm done. I think you should elaborate on it and give some context on how you accomplished that. And is that part of your process to listening to that inner voice?
Yeah. So I personally have always broken away, I think, from a lot of the publicly perceived success criteria, in the sense that I do a huge amount of work to do the minimal amount of work for the most possible return. So for me, for example, for streaming, within my niche and my category, I made an assessment a long time ago that streaming all day long, 5, 6, 7 days a week, simply was not a good spend of my time, because it's a huge spend of time, and the return that I would get from that would be positive, sure, but it would bring down the sort of average return I'm getting from a given hour of work. It's such a large volume of work for returns that I didn't feel were outsized enough to justify it. And this is philosophy that I just have inherently. This isn't something that I feel like I have sort of had a light bulb moment where I've realized I needed to do that in my business. I've always kind of had that thinking in my approach. I think it's gotten more refined over the years. But to speak to the example of the time off, there came a point in 2019 where I had been doing YouTube at that point for 10 years, and I'd actually never taken a break from working. And that doesn't mean that I had never taken a break from YouTube, in the sense that I had had, for example, during my sort of high school years, secondary school, as we call it here in the UK, I had taken like months off over the summer, for example, several times to focus on my exams. I was a very academic student. That was a real passion of mine. And so I would take 2 full months off and just revise and study crazy hard and just do like 16-hour days in the library, and then come back and resume making content, right? That was something that I did multiple times so that I could still maintain my studies alongside YouTube. But it got to 2019, and I got really burned out and realized, okay, I'd taken those sort of breaks from YouTube before, but my breaks were very deep, intense work on just another problem, my exams, which needed to be solved. So there was no actual rest there. There was no recuperation. There was nothing. And so what happened in 2019 is I got really burned out. I had some personal life stuff happen as well. A family member passed away, bits and pieces like that. What ended up being about 9 months off YouTube. And I came back after those 9 months or so and had the most lucrative year that my channel has ever had. And to me, that is as clear a signal as you'll ever get, that the publicly perceived notion of what YouTubers need to do, like, you talk to any YouTuber right now, and any YouTuber that's listening to this probably worries about questions like, what if I take a week off? Or what if I take a month off? What if I don't post at my normal schedule? Like, what if I am posting infrequently? Or what if there's a gap in my uploads or whatever, right? Those sorts of questions haunt YouTubers. And I've been haunted by those things, don't get me wrong, but I've also taken a lot of time to ask, why do I believe that in the first place? What is it that is causing me to think that the time that I'm putting in terms of upload regularity is what moves the needle? And I've experimented within my business to say, okay, what if I just ignore that public perception of what works, and I actually just run the experiment myself and see what the data says? And in that case, the data said I'd built up an audience, right? I didn't need to be so stressed about uploading every single day to maintain that audience, because I'd built trust with those people. I'd built familiarity with those people. And I also knew that I had 10 years of experience, and I knew that I'd be able to make really good content as soon as I came back to YouTube. So I sort of said, okay, well, like, screw the people that say that you need to upload every other day in order for the algorithm to like you. Like, what if that's not true? And I ran the experiment and it wasn't true. And I had a really great year afterwards. But if I'd been following the public knowledge and the public perception, which some of my viewers transparently told me I should do, like, I even had people after the fact being like, oh, you had less views this month. Like, they'd look at my Social Blade or something, some sort of arbitrary way of analyzing somebody's channel. They'd be like, your views are down, like, you've fallen off. And I'm like, I just had the most profitable year I've ever had. We are not measuring things the same way here, because to speak to your point earlier on, it really depends what the goal is as to whether or not you're successful. And if the goal is not just more views, but like less revenue, sure, I could chase more views for less revenue, but that's not what I'm personally chasing, right? For me, making my business more lucrative is really important as well. So it's a question of constantly being able to reevaluate these things. And I think that it's a muscle that all creators actually have to build, because if you aren't able to do that, if you aren't able to test and iterate and test and iterate, it also will, it will harm your videos overall. They'll just be worse because you won't be iterating and building on them and learning from them, constantly, endlessly refining. And that is something that all YouTubers need to do to make their content better in the first place, but then to keep up with trends as they change over time and all those sorts of things. And it also just means that you'll be less nimble when there are these sorts of large macro shifts in the environment, such as an actual algorithm change on YouTube, which happens extremely infrequently. So don't make the assumption of thinking that that's
the algorithm's
like
fault.
Yeah, don't be blaming the algorithm here. But when there is actually a meaningful algorithm change, I went to a YouTube event maybe 6 months ago, and they said the algorithm technically has only actually changed like 3 times since the site started. And like, most YouTubers would be like, that's not true. Like, it's machine learning, so it changes every day. This is YouTube telling me. So like, you can take that for what you will, right? The changes that happen on that macro scale, or like a new game coming out, or a new person being popular that redefines the way a genre works of content, those are the sorts of things that you will ultimately need to build into your strategy. And it's only by being willing to question yourself constantly, and then also have the confidence to back yourself in those tests and in the approaches that you build based on the data that you receive, that's how you survive, I think, long term in this industry. Because otherwise, you might find a successful pattern that works for 6 months, but that's a very different question to lasting 6 years, 12 years, 15 years, whatever.
Yeah, I think when you realize the game you're playing is much longer, because, like, I mean, being an entrepreneur, there's different games that you can play too. There's like, I want to sell this company within X time. And that puts a cap on like how long you're playing the game for. And I think the beauty of being a content creator is that the game is kind of infinite. Like, you can keep playing for a long, long time if you choose to do so, and you set it up in a way that you is sustainable. I think we've obviously seen, you know, MatPat retire. There's like these OGs that are, even with all of their success, choosing to move to the next chapter. And we've seen this over time. People like have went into employment in the industry and things like that over time. You can choose to take that path as well. Even my own journey, like, I was talent before and I chose to go into corporate, and I worked at a big company for a while, and then I started a company after that. And I think that the beauty of content creation is that it does open a lot of doors, and you can choose where that door leads. and it's not confined to the thing that you're in right now. And while being very focused on the thing that you're doing right now is important, don't let it frustrate you too much when there's like a there's so much opportunity ahead that you've yet to realize. And I think that's one of the things that I balance a lot in my own journey, and then even talking to whether it's an employee or another creator, is how much perspective is too much perspective. Like, knowing about things outside of the thing you're doing, and this is something me and you, Milo, wrestle with a lot, because we jam on a lot of different projects, and I'm like, I can't tell Milo about this, because if I tell Milo, he's going to get too excited, and he's going to spend too much time thinking about it. How do you find that balance of taking in information and trying to implement that or make sense of it for you, your journey, relative to just focusing on the thing that you're doing that's right in front of you, whether that's the video or the next 10 videos or this game launch that's coming up?
I personally have the Milo way, and then I have the way that I would tell, like, my clients, for example, if I'm doing a one-to-one helping sort of like audit their channel, for instance, right? So I have the path of success that I recommend to most, and I have the path that I walk. And admittedly, sometimes
they are
sometimes very, very different paths. The reason they're different is that I have built a path that really works for the type of person that I am. And it is ridiculous, the notion that that would therefore transferably work for everyone else, right? And so when I'm doing an audit of someone's channel or what have you, I try and get an understanding of who they are and how they work, and then help build them a strategy that suits them, right? So for me personally, I am not the sort of person that carves out a lot of high-level ideas of, like, here's where I'm at right now with my channel, and here's where it's going, and here's what I'm going to be doing next week and next month, and this is my overall content strategy, and this is what my week looks like even. This is my rhythm. This is when I stream. This is when I don't stream. I don't do any of those things. I am a 100% agent of chaos in my own life, where I much prefer to pretty much take every day as it comes. And it means that I don't know what country I'll be in 2 weeks' time. And I love life like that. That really suits me. However, it really doesn't suit most people. So the flip side answer is, I think it's really important to find things within your life and your business and the content, etc., that are almost the non-negotiables for you. Like, for example, if you got a family and you need to spend time with the family at certain times of day and, like, all those sorts of things, those become things that I would never say, ooh, let's shift those around a little bit so that we can, like, put content there instead. I'm very much of the perspective that the whole point of, well, I say whole point, one of the great benefits of being a content creator should, in theory, be the fact that you are your own boss and you are defining the type of life that you want to live in the work that you do. And I think it's kind of easy to sometimes be like, oh, well, like, you should be working all the time so that you can blow up this really novel business. But if it comes at the expense of things like your family time, for instance, if that's one of your non-negotiables, then you're just as much a slave to the machine as you were before you became a content creator. So, like, are you really getting something out of it in that regard? Or are you just making life hard for yourself for the sake of it, right? So I would assess what those non-negotiables are. And then beyond that point, I flex again quite a lot here in terms of, if I'm working with somebody that really works well in the kind of chaos similar to what I do, then I would never say to them, you need to have an understanding of what your every single day is going to be like or every single week is going to be like. With that sort of person, I would say, don't worry about being super granular, but let's just talk like high level goals, because it's really important to think about the 5-year plan, for example, even if that doesn't really matter to you in that moment, right? It just pays to have at least thought about that a bit. So it might be like, okay, within the niche that you're in right now and the type of content you're doing right now and all those sorts of things, do you see yourself doing that in 5 years' time? Not 1 year, because 1 year is, yeah, 1 year is, yeah, it's not that far away, but five tends to sort of unearth different thoughts in people. And it's kind of a scary amount of time for some people. They're like, oh, Christ, 5 years doing what I'm doing right now, that might be a bit much. Or for other people, they're like, yeah, give me more, give me 10, right? So that's usually a fun starting point and an insightful starting point. It really illuminates a lot. And then you can work down the scale from there and say, okay, got an idea of the fact that in 5 years' time, you actually want to be doing exactly what you're doing right now. Or it's you have aspirations to be less plugged into what you're doing right now day to day, but you want to like manage a team of people that does this kind of thing. You just want to graduate into a more sort of senior management role. Or it's you want to use this as a vehicle to getting an adjacent tangential job in the industry or whatever it might be, right?
Launching a new business, whatever it is, yeah.
And there's a million paths that that could take, and it's custom to every person. And then I'd say, okay, well, like, let's go back now. Let's make it a one-year plan, right? If it's 1 year and we're still driving towards some kind of nebulous five-year goal, what needs to happen in this 1 year to get us in that direction, but also just so that the year was a success? Like, we don't want this year to be all trials and tribulations so that you finally feel like you've succeeded in year five. We want to make sure that you have wins along the way too, right? So then we talk about the 1 year plan, and then we can work it back further still and say, okay, like, what about next month? What's happening in the next month that needs to get you towards the 1 year goal? Maybe it's more granular still for that person. Maybe it's then a week or a day or what have you. And you can infinitely drill down. You can talk about, yeah, my day-to-day time blocking could be improved, for example. Like, you can really get in the weeds with it. But I think the crucial thing is to make sure that that overall high level long-term plan is sort of in place and you're driving towards that. And so to bring it back to me, I am endlessly curious about everything, right? And I want to drink from the fire hose of all things content creation, right? So if I have an opportunity to act as a part-time CMO, just so that I can drink from that fire hose and have to learn on the fly and do all of that stuff while simultaneously teaching creators and getting data input in real time as to what struggles they're facing at the very starts of their careers, and I can help manage creators on a creator campaign. I just last week, I acted as the intermediary between a creator friend of mine and a brand that needed help, and I made the deal happen. I organized the entire thing, and I was the intermediary there, right? And all of these things, in my view, benefit me in the sense that the ongoing data collection that I'm doing right now fuels all of my thoughts on this space, and all of the work that I do, even just making an individual video game guide, is still informed by that wider context. And so for me, that investment into the broader umbrella of topics and ideas and work is always worth it. Whereas another person might say, okay, actually, I just want to really get good at my one thing, right? I want to be a master of one, not a jack of all trades. And in that case, it would be a very different conversation. But that, for me personally, is not how I operate, but it is definitely how many people need to approach things. It's just that the challenge is that as a creator, there is never one thing that you can be good at that means that the other stuff doesn't matter. You could be great at making a thumbnail, but still got to make a title, still got to produce the video, like all those sorts of things. And so
yeah,
that is a really crucial.
Knowing, even like, people get kind of like annoyed by the have a five-year vision thing. But it's not to like crystallize that necessarily.
Some people, not at all.
It's just directionally, am I going in the direction that I want my life to go? Mm. And you can recalibrate on that with some reasonable cadence, a year, 2 years, whatever it is for you. You can recalibrate because people evolve, people change. You might have a family and then that changes your priorities, or you might move country and that changes whatever it is for you. It does really help to make sure you're kind of rowing in the right direction, and the people around your life are also coming on that journey with you. Sometimes decisions need to be made about people not going in that direction with you.
Yep.
As well. And also, one of the things you touched on there that I thought was worth elaborating on is this idea that it has to be a struggle. Yes, it is hard work, and I think we beat it into ourselves that if we're suffering, we're doing something right. You know?
So
true. And I think a lot of creators suffer in silence for a long, long time deeply resenting the work that they're having to do on this journey of like becoming successful. And it kind of builds and builds and builds, but then they're like, oh, I need to be so grateful because I get to be my own boss and I get to make videos for a living, and that's great. And there's this like real paradox that they're holding between doing this thing that they love and doing this thing that requires all their energy and this massive amount of suffering. And I do think there is an easier way. And part of what you said is like choosing where you're willing to make compromises or not make compromises. What are your non-negotiables? What are your boundaries around that? And making those things that you plant in your life as the constraints that you operate around. Obviously, you need to get to a certain level of freedom to make that possible. It's very challenging to do that in the very, very beginning. But as you evolve in your career, you start to have a lot more agency in that than it may have felt like you had when you were first starting out.
With regards to it feeling like a struggle, one of the most liberating things you can do for yourself as a creator is to lay out all the assumptions you have that are making your life difficult, and then ask yourself to prove those things to yourself. Not just to think it, prove it. What is the proof that your channel will die if you don't upload 3 times a week? Where did you get that from? Like, why do you trust Google or some Reddit post more than you trust the data from your own channel, right? And if it's from your own channel, right, that is so valid as well. Like, I am not saying, oh, all of the data collection you've ever done is wrong here, right? But if it's from your own channel, start to self-interrogate, whether or not you have made false assumptions about the data that you're looking at. Because I did a physics degree, right? And I only mention that because it means that I have familiarity with numbers and statistics that is very, it's an intimate connection, right? I've done a lot of stats modules in my life. And that's a real benefit for me, I think, because it means that I can look at a data set and I can look at the sorts of things that my YouTube analytics, for example, might be seeming to tell me. And I can do some of that self-interrogation to say, am I actually making a truly logical inference based on what I'm looking at here, right? And I think people have gut reactions about what they think the data should be saying. Like if a video fell off, for example, like they post a video and it's not good, and they're like, oh, I need to find a reason why it fell off, right? So they're already sort of begging the question, if you will. They're already setting up or leading the question. They're setting up an environment for them to have to draw a conclusion that they think that they should be making rather than just what the data is saying. And then within that moment, it might be that the first thing that they come across is like, oh, it's probably because of this, right? And it's like, okay, well, we can make those sorts of judgment calls. And as you build that muscle as a creator to have done this 1,000 times, as you do those reps, you'll get better and better at those snap judgments being on the money. But there is also a lot of room for you to actually just be wrong and re-examining those things and saying, oh, right, okay, like maybe yes, the YouTube guru that I follow on Twitter said one thing about this, and that might be true in that world, but maybe that actually doesn't apply to me in the way that I just slapped it on there like it was a one-size-fits-all kind of piece of knowledge that applies to all niches or all industries or whatever. Maybe that's actually worth digging into a little bit and trying to kind of unpack and prove to myself, right? And I think that a lot of creators, even with millions and millions of subscribers, I talk to them regularly and I hear them say things that I just flagrantly disagree with. And I interrogate those things with them and they're like, oh, well, I just feel like it. I feel like that's the case. And I'm like, nah, stop it. We're not doing feel here. Let's absolutely hear out why you have an emotional attachment to that concept.
There's probably something there. There's something there that's worth exploring.
By all means. And even if the data says nothing, right? Even if this is not a data thing, this is an emotions thing, it's still worth giving yourself grace and treating yourself nicely in the way that you unpack that. I'm not saying that you should just be like a completely unfeeling in your approach, because this is a very complex thing to emotionally remove yourself, because you are so infused into your content so much of the time, right? So I'm not saying that you have to be totally sterile about it, but when you feel something with regards to your approach in business, I think that as the leader of the ship, right, the captain of the ship, the leader of the organization, as the creator in charge, you need, or as the creator CEO, you need to do yourself the favor of asking yourself why those assumptions or why those feelings are there in the first place, and then acting as your own boss to give yourself space to perhaps decide, oh, you know what? This is an emotional response that I'm having that has reason behind it and is valid and is worth really addressing carefully, but it also shouldn't be the sole reason that I change XYZ about my business just to accommodate that. Like, maybe there is a world where both things can coexist or what have you.
Yeah, I can share an example personally how that impacted me. Is I now have a team of 40 at Zygo that I'm responsible for. But one of the things when I first started the company and was building it, I looked to podcasts or interviews or you know, different material from like Y Combinator, like all these different sources, and I would reference what it meant to be a CEO from them. And I almost built this as like, this is how a CEO should act, and got so far away from how I wanted to act and how I wanted to show up, which was unique to me. And ever since, like, kind of breaking that pattern of operating from a place of shoulds to what felt better inside of me, significantly better results, and feels way better to me to lead from that place than this is how I should operate. It's not to say that stuff is not valuable, but for it to dictate how I operate, that was a mistake that I made early on in my journey as a CEO.
So in the moment of you making that sort of decision, for lack of a better word, when you were sort of looking to those reference materials and building out that picture, if you could go back to that moment in time now and give yourself some advice to sort of steer yourself onto the right path there, what would you say to kind of convince yourself that doing it differently or doing it against the grain would be a better path for you?
The thing that I was reconciling with the time was that my ambition was way up here. My actual experience, like evidence that I had built up, was not to the level of my ambition. So I looked elsewhere to kind of garner the roadmap or the confidence that I could kind of steal from or sponge from to help me like level up to kind of meet my aspiration. The thing that I would say to myself at that point in time is that information is valuable, and seek to learn, seek to be a student, but build my own discernment around what is true for me. I think that is, if I just did that, I would have netted out, you know, more positively. And it's not to say like I went through all that. I don't regret any of it, but that's the one thing that I would share from my experience, is building your own discernment and critical thinking about where you are, and not indexing too highly on the journey of other people.
Yeah, so, so true, I think, and something that I would echo for the people listening here, and I think that's actually a really lovely way of summarizing much of what we've just discussed, is indexing your decision-making based on the actions of others is absolutely a tool in your arsenal, but it shouldn't be the only one, and it's important to also include yourself in that process, right? And I don't think a lot of creators do that in the way that they maybe could.
Milo, this was absolutely incredible. I loved kicking off our inaugural episode together and welcoming you to the podcast. I am excited to do more together. I would love to know, for those listening, like what you thought of this episode. It's also new. We're bringing on Milo as a co-host. Milo, you're going to have different folks that you know on the pod as well. There's different topics that you're excited to chat about, independent of us jamming together. So just really excited about how the pod evolves. And, you know, if this last 30, 40 minutes is any taste of what's to come, I am very excited.
Hell yeah. It's been a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to going down the rabbit hole with yourself, Stephen, and plenty of other fun guests over the next several weeks, months, and years. It's going to be a really exciting time, I think. So I'm pumped. I'm looking forward to it.